Good afternoon, everybody. It's my pleasure to introduce our first speaker of this afternoon session. She also happened to be one of our colleagues and friend, Dr. Rima Slim. Very quickly, her sketch. She graduated and trained as a postdoctoral fellow in Pasteur Institute in Paris. Then she joined Beirut American University, where she initiated an independent research on genetics of familial recurrent hydatidiform moles. In 2002, she joined McGill University, Department of Oxygeny and Human Genetics, and her research interest continues to be familial recurrent hydatidiform moles. And I knew I won't be able to pronounce this hydatidiform mole, but it's fine. Her group was the first one to identify NALT7 gene as the major maternal effect gene for this condition. Her current research focus is on understanding NALT7 gene's functional role in pathology of moles and also identifying new genes for reproductive wastage. So, Rima.
Thanks, Asangla, for the nice introduction. Thank you for the organizers for giving me the opportunity to talk about the research work of my group. So I will talk about we work on the genetics of hydatidiform moles, and if you cannot pronounce it, you can say molar pregnancy, it's much easier. So this condition basically, it is a human pregnancy with no embryo. And the paradoxical nature of this pregnancy, so pregnancy and no embryo, has fascinated and puzzled scientists since the time of Hippocrates. And it is of ancient recognition, and what we see in his manuals, basically, is exactly what we see at the gross morphology level. So here we have a molar pregnancy on the as it appears on ultrasound, and this is a normal pregnancy. So at gestational week 8, we should see a gestational sac and a fetal heart activity. While in a molar pregnancy, there is no gestational sac in the typical mole. And we have these echogenic structures. And after this initial observation by the clinician, he would request the pregnancy hormone test, which is very high in the case of molar pregnancy, reflecting the high proliferation of the placenta. And here we have a mole in the evacuation room. It is full of blood, and you can see these vesicles. And if we take this product to the lab and we lyse the blood, we see these grape-like structures. And in a typical mole, there is no embryo at all. We just see these chorionic villi. They have accumulated fluid, and they represent a large older placenta. So after the confirmation of the initial ultrasound diagnosis and the beta-HCG test, we have dilatation and curettage suction, and the product is sent for histopathological examinations. And the diagnosis is made based on histopathology, where the pathologist would examine the tissue and would classify them into two types. Complete moles, where we have excessive trophoblast proliferation, no embryo at all, and no fetal vessels inside chorionic villi. In the partial mole, it's somehow a little milder phenotype. We have milder trophoblastic proliferation, some embryonic structures, and we might have a completely formed embryo, and also we have a mixture of normal appearing villi and abnormal villi. At the epidemiological level, there is a common form of this condition, and the common mole is sporadic and is not recurrent, meaning that we see unrelated patients, and each one will have only one mole, after normal pregnancies or between them or before them. But it happens only once. These are sporadic, non-recurrent moles. And the frequency of this condition in the common form, the sporadic form, is 1 in 600 pregnancies in Western countries, and it is higher in Asian and Southeastern countries, where it reaches 1 in 60 pregnancies. And for these moles, we believe that these are due to multifactorial etiologies, including some genetic factors and some environmental factors, all together leading to a mole a single time. So for a geneticist to say that there is a genetic defect, an event has to recur. In 1 to 6% of the patients, we see a woman with a prior mole will have a second mole. And these, we call them recurrent moles. They affect 1 to 6% of these of patients with one mole. And if we count any reproductive loss these patients might have, 10 to 25% of patients who had a prior mole will have a second reproductive loss. And here, basically, we believe that there are stronger genetic factors because the event is recurring a second time or in a milder form. And very rarely, we see several members, unrelated women from the same family, sisters or cousins, who have recurrent moles. And these are the familial cases of recurrent moles. And we don't know the incidence of this condition because these are rare. From histopathological and genotyping data from cytogenetics and some microsatellite markers, we know that 50% of complete moles are diploid, and the second half, they are partial moles and they are triploid. In the complete moles, they are diploid, but in 80% they are androgenetic. So when we use markers from the to see the maternal chromosome, there are no maternal genetic material. They are 100% androgenetic. In 70% of the cases, they come from a single sperm, monospermic fertilization, or 10% dispermic fertilization. And the 20% are biparental. In partial moles, they are mostly triploid dispermic. So we have 69 chromosomes, one set from the mother, two from the father, from two different sperms, and the remaining are diploid, biparental, like normal karyotype. So basically, the data I showed you here, basically, they date back to 1970. And since that time, we have kind of accepted the following mechanism. So to have something androgenetic monospermic, it has to come from an empty oocyte fertilized by a single sperm, and then the paternal single sperm would duplicate and will have androgenetic monospermic moles, homozygous at all polymorphic traits. And dispermic moles, they come from the fertilization of two sperms when they fertilize an empty oocyte. However, we have no scientific evidence of this mechanism. It's just we are trying to reconstitute or we make a story from what we see in the moles. So we started our work on this condition because an excellent gynecologist-oncologist, he crossed his discipline and he came to consult with a geneticist to ask her about a weird observation he saw in his patients. So he had three patients, two sisters and their cousin from the same family who had recurrent moles. So here I have the symbol of a hydatidiform mole and a spontaneous abortion. And I would like to remember that these patients did not have only moles. Though even we were attracted by the molar weird phenotype, but they had all types of reproductive losses. So this one had four spontaneous abortions, five, followed by a stillbirth, then two moles, three spontaneous abortions, one mole, etc. And here, each had a live birth of a normal baby and a healthy, normal adult. Because patients with recurrent moles, usually they fail to have normal pregnancies, and some of them did the experiment and they changed their partners. So this patient, for instance, she had a mole with a first partner, a mole with a second partner, and with a third partner, she had several moles. So because they keep having recurrent moles, even when they change partners, we suggested that a maternal affected gene underlies this condition. And it was in 1999, and we did a whole genome mapping. We found linkage to chromosome 19, and then we did a positional cloning approach, and we found the causative gene for this condition. The gene name, the abbreviation, is NLRP7, and it's a major inflammatory gene responsible for recurrent moles. NLRP7 stands for nucleotide oligomerization domain-like receptor protein, number 7. And that gene has three domains. The pyrin domain, is found in, it's kind of a glue adapter protein that helps binding proteins from the Death machinery. The NACT domain, is found in a neuronal apoptosis inhibitor proteins. And also inside this domain, there is an ATPase domain, which kind regulates efflux from mitochondria and leads to apoptosis. The leucine-rich repeat, there are 10 in NLRP7, and these are found in toll-like receptors. They are found in RAN GTPases and in RNase inhibitor proteins. To date, there are more than 60 mutations in this gene described, and more than 200 patients. And if we take patients from any population, about 48 to 80% of the patients have two mutations in this gene. That's why we say it's a major gene for this condition. So the patients have two defective copies, one coming from their mother and one coming from their father. And because of this recessive defect, they fail to conceive. So other genes from the same family as NLRP7, a well-known one is NOD2, responsible for Crohn disease, and another gene responsible for familial Mediterranean fever. So these are both conditions, Crohn and familial Mediterranean fever, they are characterized by recurrent inflammation and fever. Recently, a second gene named KHDC3L was also identified as a gene responsible for recurrent moles in some patients who are negative for mutations in NLRP7. This gene, it maps to chromosome 6. We know so far 6 unrelated patients, 2 from familial cases, and 4 mutations have been described. So because the link between NLRP gene families and autoinflammatory diseases, we looked first at the response of patient cells to lipopolysaccharide stimulation, and we looked at the secretion of some cytokines. And here I am showing you IL-1 beta secretion by patient cells. So here we took peripheral blood mononuclear cells. The colored are from the patients, and the gray are from the controls. And patient cells, basically, statistically, they secrete less IL-1 beta than control cells. So we wanted to know what is going on inside the cells, the same cells that are secreting less IL-1 beta. So here we have a control and a patient, and you can see that in the patient we have even a higher amount of pro-IL-1 beta, and at the level of mature IL-1 beta, they have kind of equal level. Just the secretion is abnormal. We then added more patients, 2 with mutations, several with rare variants, and here we have the ratio between patient and the experimental control for intracellular pro-IL-1 beta, intracellular mature IL-1 beta, and then the secreted IL-1 beta. We can see we have variable levels. Kind of the mature is equivalent to the produced pro-IL-1 beta. The major defect that is common to all patients, they fail to get the IL-1 beta outside the cells. So basically, this suggested that NALP7 mutations interfere somehow directly or indirectly with IL-1 beta secretion. So to do so, they have to be expressed in the same cells. In our peripheral blood mononuclear cells, IL-1 beta is secreted by monocytes. And here we have a monocyte. We have in pink gamma tubulin and in green NALP7. And NALP7 localizes to the microtubular organizing center. So basically, we believe that by its location, it kind of helps structure the microtubule. And if this structure is impaired, the vesicles containing IL-1 beta cannot go through the microtubules to go out to the extracellular milieu. And then we wanted to explore more the subcellular localization of this gene in other cellular types. So we looked at fibroblasts. So fibroblasts, they have a well-developed cytoskeleton. And here we can see we have microtubular signal. So basically, it's a confirmation that this protein kind of associates or binds to microtubules. So we wanted to know what happened in the cells from the patients. So when we looked at the fibroblasts from two patients, we observed the same subcellular localization, but the cells from the patients were smaller. So here we have fibroblasts from the patients and the control, and they are stained with gamma tubulin. So they are smaller, they have less branching, and if we do the statistics, they are here, it is a significant difference. We looked at the Golgi apparatus, the patient and the control, and the patient have collapsed Golgi toward the nucleus, more than a spread stack. And again, this difference is significant. This is a maternal effect, right? So a maternal affected gene, it acts. These patients are normal. They don't complain of any health problem. Just when they try to conceive, they have a molar pregnancy. So the defect has to be in the germline of these patients. At that time when we found that gene, we looked at the expression of this gene in oocyte and early cleavage status, and it was expressed. Later, another study, they did quantitative PCR and they RT-PCR, and they found that the transcript of this gene, they decrease from the germinal vesicle to day 3, and then they go up. At the protein level, the protein is expressed in all follicular stages and only in the, or mainly in the oocyte. And by immunofluorescence, this is at around the time of fertilization. The main signal is in the cortical region. And also in the flagellum of the sperm, we can see also it is stained with NLRP7. So after, when the embryo starts to divide, NLRP7, it redistributes to go to the cortical region, and it is not in the cell-to-cell contact region. While cadherin, it is in the cell-to-cell contact region. And this polarity basically remains from the two cell to the morula stage. So it is absent from the middle, it is outside. And at the blastocyst stage, we see NALP7 loses its polarity, but it's expressed in the inner cell mass and the trophectoderm layer. So here we have a magnification of an oocyte. You can see that you have these dark spots. So to understand where is the location exactly, we did electron microscopy to see what are the organelles in this part of the oocyte. So what we have basically here in the cortical region, we have vacuoles, we have mitochondria, we have smooth endoplasmic reticulum, we have cortical granules. And if you do immunolabeling, NLRP7, it binds to some structures outside the cortical granules and between mitochondria and cellular organelles. So basically this leads us to the conclusion that this protein, it is related to cytoskeletal proteins, and it is needed to have a normal cytoskeleton. So in molar pregnancies, basically, they are diagnosed and they are evacuated and they are in the first trimester between week 7 to week 12. So we wanted to know, if we study the genotype of these conceptions, what do we see? So from these tissues, what we have available is formalin-fixed, paraffin-embedded tissues from which the DNA is degraded. We cannot do everything we want, but we have limitations. But what is known in the field, or so far before our work, about 70 molar pregnancies from these patients have been characterized at the genotypic level, and they were all found diploid biparental. So with a normal chromosomal complement. Only one was found triploid digenic with two copies of the maternal genome and one copy of the paternal genome. And basically this one is believed to be a failure of the polar body extrusion. So we wanted all these moles were characterized by a single method. So we believe that maybe a single method is not enough to characterize these difficult tissues. We would like to take a more comprehensive approach and try to see if there are some chromosomal abnormalities that we are missing. So we did an approach on 27 molar tissues from patients who have two defective alleles or two mutations in NALP7. So in these patients, the cause of their moles are the mutations in this protein. So we did first flow cytometry to determine the ploidy of the cells. They were all diploid. We did microsatellite genotyping. We used a multiplex kit for 16 markers and to determine the maternal and paternal alleles. And also we used fluorescent in situ hybridization with centromeric probes from several chromosomes, 3 to 6. And all the 27 moles that we characterized, we found that they are all diploid biparental. Only one we found it mosaic, XY 90% of the cells, and XX 10% of the cells. So basically, if we take these findings with the previous finding, our data, even if we use different approaches, there we don't have diaspermic fertilization is not the major problem in these molar tissues. We don't have abnormal polar body extrusion in them. Mostly they are diploid biparental. So something else is occurring. So because NALP7 in fibroblast affects organelle distribution, we wanted to look at organelle distribution in the conceptions. But the only organelle that we can trace in a conception are mitochondria because they have DNA. So we looked at the mitochondrial number in two conceptions, only two conceptions because we needed high-quality DNA. So this is possible only for tissues from which we had fresh material, not the formalin-fixed paraffin-embedded. So, and then we looked at six normal conceptions, 6 to 7 weeks. So we have a high number of mitochondria. It seems to be lower at 11 to 12 weeks. And in the two moles from our two patients, was lower. And this difference is significant. So basically, we have lower mitochondrial copy number, but because we only were able to study two tissues, we cannot generalize that this is happening in all of them. But there is no reason to believe that only mitochondria are not segregating well two daughter cells. If we have an abnormal cytoskeleton, basically the cytoskeleton is very important in the oocyte. It is important for the maturation of the oocyte and the positioning of the different organelles. The cortical granules, we know that their exocytosis should occur in response to fertilization to prevent polyspermic fertilization. And also the polarity of this molecule and several other maternal affected genes are essential for the partition of organelle and maternal supplies like protein mRNA from the oocyte to daughter cells in order to sustain early embryonic development until the activation of the fetal, the embryonic genome. So we wanted basically to see if this molecule is affecting the development of the embryo, there should be correlations between the type of the mutations and embryonic development. So we went back to the formalin-fixed paraffin-embedded tissues, and we asked two histopathologists to characterize them and to score them at all the features of moles. And then we put here, we have the mutations. So we found basically two categories of moles. Or we were able to divide them into two types of moles. We also, to do this work, we used a marker. It is P57KIP2. This protein is a product of the CDKN1C. It's a cyclin inhibitor kinase. It is a paternally imprinted, maternally expressed gene. It is used by pathologists because when they have moles that they cannot divide into complete and partial types, they use this marker to say if the maternal genome is present or not. So if the marker is absent, they would say there is no maternal genome and this sporadic mole is most likely androgenetic. When it's present, they say this is most likely a partial mole because we have presence of this gene. But also this protein is a marker, it is involved in the balance between tissue differentiation and tissue proliferation. So what we saw is that all these moles are diploid biparental. They have no chromosomal abnormalities. We had 17 of them that were P57 negative and 12 that were P57 positive. All the P57 negative did not have any type of embryonic tissues of inner cell mass origin, like fetal membranes or nucleated red blood cells inside the chorionic villi. And most of them, they were diagnosed as partial moles, while the positive ones, most of them had some types of embryonic tissues of inner cell mass origin. Fetal membrane, chorion, amnion, and nucleated red blood cells inside the vessels. And these moles were diagnosed as partial moles. Among our patients, we had only 4 who had at least one protein truncating mutation in the coding region. And all these mutations were in the first category. So what we have here, severe mutations are associated with absence of embryonic development, and probably they are embryonic development arrest earlier than in these cases where we have missense mutations. They are somehow permissive or tolerant to some kind of embryonic tissues differentiation. And in all the tissues, whenever we have absence of embryonic tissues, we had more trophoblast proliferation. And when embryonic tissues start to differentiate, kind of the proliferation machinery is shifted to a lower extent. So if we were to put all these data together and come up with a single mechanism, the most logical one for us is that the roots of all these problems are in the oocyte cytoskeleton. So we have an oocyte with abnormal cytoskeleton. Maybe it is unable to mature, or maybe it's unable to have normal distribution of organelle and maternal supplies that are not partitioned very well into daughter cells. And this would lead to mostly diploid biparental daughter cells, but with different parts, with different numbers of organelle and supplies that would not develop. So here we have impaired differentiation of embryonic tissues of inner cell mass origin. Because the patients are unable to secrete, because of the same defect, they are not able to secrete cytokine, so these patients are not able to reject these dead pregnancy at an early stage. They keep them until a longer stage, until a time where they manifest as a mole. So basically, if we want to summarize in a single sentence, we have a cytoskeletal defect leading to the retention of an early arrested pregnancy, retention of a dead pregnancy. That's basically our story until now. I would like to thank the patients and their families for their contribution to this work. I thank you for your attention, and I would like to thank the students from my lab, Eli Akuri, who did most of the immunofluorescence work on oocyte and cells, Fong and Guyen, who did all the tedious work of genotyping on the paraffin-embedded tissues. Also, some work on KHDC3L was done by Ramesh and Christine. I want to also thank Jibin, Christian, and Wafa, previous members of the lab who contributed to different parts of this work. Also, an important part when we do human genetics, we cannot do it on our own in our lab. We have to connect with a large network of clinicians and scientists all over the world, and basically their collaboration is essential to do this work. And I would like also to thank Asangla Au. All the embryo work and all the genotyping work were run in her lab, and all this was possible because of the collaboration of Li Zhang, who contributed in an exceptional way to this project. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you, Rima. If you have any questions, please.
Thank you for this beautiful story. Recurrent pregnancy loss is a common clinical problem. And in genetics, commonly when a rare situation gives us a genetic abnormality, those genetics bleed out sometimes into more common conditions. Have you looked at cohorts of patients with recurrent pregnancy loss in the absence of moles to see if you might have more modest mutations or effects of this gene?
Yeah. Very good question, basically. Because the patients basically did not have only moles, they had all this spectrum of phenotype. Basically, we looked, and before our work, almost 20 years ago, there are some nice papers where people at the epidemiological level, they have reported that patients with recurrent spontaneous abortions, they have a higher incidence of moles than women from the general population. And also in these reports, they say that they have more stillbirths and they have more of all the complications of the pregnancies. So we looked at a cohort of spontaneous abortions, and we reported that 7%. So these are patients who have only at least 3 spontaneous abortions and no moles at all. We found 2 missense in heterozygous state, 1 in each patient. In the 25, we found it in 2. So 7% the frequency of a single missense mutation. And also our patients, when we took a larger cohort of patients, they have about 13% of them, they have stillbirths. The frequency of stillbirths in the general population is less than 1%.
Rima, just a quick question about the trafficking defect that you found. Do you think it's more general than just interleukin signaling, or do you think that this protein is involved in trafficking of other growth factors or other things?
Yeah. So I did not show the data on TNF-alpha, but we also checked in these cells TNF-alpha. And it was in parallel going, again, low like IL-1-beta. Though TNF-alpha has a different secretion pathway independent of IL-1-beta. It's a very good question. In view the association of this molecule with microtubule, we expect several proteins. Is it all? I would say no, but we expect many other proteins to be defect, to manifest defective secretion, and we are trying to do some kind of proteomics approaches on primary fibroblasts from patients and controls. Thank you. Yeah. So basically what I also forget to mention that now patients with recurrent MORS, they seek DNA testing, and if they have mutations in this gene, their chances from our statistics and the statistics of other groups to have a normal pregnancy is low. It is possible, and that's why, like say, I showed you that some of these patients had normal pregnancy. So how do we explain the normal pregnancy? We say that maybe, this is a hypothetical, maybe in this normal pregnancy, by chance, by coincidence, by luck, these daughter cells had abnormal complement of organelle and mRNA and the protein, and they were able to make it. But in about 2 to 5% of their conceptions, they can have a live birth. So what do they do? Do they wait the 2 to 5%? Definitely not. There is a report about one patient who had ovum donation, and she had a normal pregnancy. And also among our patients, we have two others. So basically, we have 50 patients. We have two others. We are aware they tried ovum donation and it worked with them. So basically, view of the data, ovum donation is a faster way to get pregnant.